Talk given Friday, 6th February, 1976. I wonder how many people watch the moving of the hands of a clock . The movement of those hands brings one hand into different relationships with the other hand. And you get positions which are symmetrically balanced positions. And it is rather wonderful to watch that movement of the minute hand as it comes into a symmetrically balancing position with the hour hand. As a simple example, around about 9 o'clock, after 9 o'clock, when the minute hand keeps moving round, it'll come into the position where it is like that, compared with the hour hand. See? And similarly at 2:45, and so on and so on. You can watch this process. There is a very interesting point in this connection. A clock is a mechanism. And we associate the idea of something dead, unalive, with a mechanism. We think of it as non-living movement. And yet, it's an extraordinary thing that this very regular tick-tock of the clock and the movement of the hands of a clock, which register what we call time, also express, if we are sensitive to it, the rhythmic pulse of eternity. And if we look at the movements of the hands of a clock that way, we begin to feel somewhat free of this tyranny of time. We think of it more as a rhythm of life rather than as making us aware of the almost mechanically perfect rotation and of the earth around its own axis and the revolution of the earth around the sun. The physical fact of the earth in relation to the sun is truly a rhythmic living fact. But our minds have become so conditioned, so ill-conditioned perhaps, that we have brought down to the level of the tomb, the grave, that which in reality is alive, though it registers continuously birth and death together. The importance of all this is not in the particular ideas which I have just tried to present. The importance of this lies in relating these ideas to the fact of our actual mode of awareness of our existence. We are so little aware of our own life rhythm as such. And I mention this particularly because we touched upon this matter of our life rhythm when we last met here. The life rhythm which finds its concretest expression in our own living body in terms of the breath rhythm, the rhythm of the breathing. If the rhythm of the breathing of a living body is always a perfect rhythm, which means, of course, a movement which is elastic, it is not mechanically fixed, it is an elastic rhythm. If that rhythm is always a perfect rhythm, we would be living in eternity, knowing the fact of eternity as we move through time. Now, if that is the case, if that can be the case, all the transcendent aspect which is involved in that word, eternity, all those transcendent aspects become a real fact in ever-varying expressions of our thought and feeling, our speech and our action in the process of our daily life, a 24-hour life. You see, what is involved in this rhythm of the breath? We have all watched animals sleeping, our pet dog or pet cat or whatever it is. Many of us have watched our infants as they sleep and so forth. And we have been aware of this extraordinary rhythm. This rhythm of life, of the creature in sleep. If that rhythm of life permeates every moment of our life, and we are capable of not letting it get disturbed in any way, then we are living as full human beings transcendentally. Because, I say this, because every single disturbance of that rhythm betokens an ill condition of me, the whole person, the psychophysical organism. And if it betokens an ill state, it means that I am not in the full human state. I am subhuman. What does religion religious living do? Restores you to perfect relationship with the universal life rhythm and enables you as the person to establish and live constantly animated by your own particular life rhythm, your own particular breath rhythm. This is another way of understanding the meaning of that word yoga. This joining together, as it is called, the root of the word is yuj, meaning in the first instance in the ordinary physical sense, to yoke together. The word originates from a people who were pastoral nomads, whose life was based on subsistence agriculture. And for subsistence agriculture, the animal of the homestead, the animals of the homestead played a very important part. And they were yoked together in order to carry out all those activities by which the life of the body, of the whole organism, was sustained. And this word yoga, which is derived from yuj, means not so much a yoking together, a joining together in any sort of mechanical sense, which is merely a putting together, putting bits together, is a mechanical synthesizing. But it means releasing into such living interrelationship with the totality that there is this true integration of the part, which is you yourself, I myself, into the totality. Now it is not as if any part is ever separate from the totality in fundamental and absolute fact. Where is the separation? The separation is in my awareness, in my mode of awareness, in my consciousness. I am unconscious. I am asleep. I am unawake. I deliberately shut the eye of vision to reality, to the truth. Unconsciously I do it out of ignorance. Consciously I do it because my conditioning since I was born is such that I have become the slave of my pleasure drive. I take sides. I exert preferential choice in favor of pleasure against pain. And thereby I myself establish the condition for conflict within the psyche. And in doing that, my breath rhythm is the first to suffer. It registers the disharmony. My brain cannot know it in the ordinary way. I may wake up to it only when the disturbance is very great, as for instance, under the stress of sudden fear or a great anxiety overwhelming one, or anger or aversion or anything like that. You see what I'm getting at? This state of harmony, this state of being truly human and remaining truly human, not by compulsion from the intellect, but remaining so spontaneously and naturally, this state has as its indispensable basis the healthiness, the maturity of mind and heart. And the healthiness of the human mind simply is another way of saying that it is pure, that it is clean. Here the analogy with the body is complete. If the body is unclean anywhere, in any way, impure, not functioning properly, it is not healthy. The body is not sane. So too with the mind. The pure body is a healthy body, a sane body. The pure mind is a healthy mind, a sane mind, which has every chance of functioning as a mature mind from beginning to end, in any situation, in every situation. Now, this statement must not be misunderstood. It does not mean that the mind will serve me in such a way that it will bring about a desired result, a preconceived result. This is quite a mistake. The very fact that there is desire which is associated with a preconception of the shape in which that desire shall be fulfilled, that very fact is evidence that the mind is in the ill state. You see, some of these teachings, which as far as I'm aware, as far as our Indo-European civilization is concerned, did originate somewhere in northern India, Iran, that region, from the Fertile Crescent, the Euphrates-Tigris region, eastwards to the Himalayas. Somewhere there, these ideas originated. And the teaching of desirelessness, complete desirelessness, is one which is very, very difficult indeed. Especially those whose socio-cultural heritage tends to emphasize individuality. Especially those people find it very difficult to swallow this idea of desirelessness. If you are going to be totally desireless, they say, then you are going to be a non-entity. In this statement is implied the assumption that to be an entity is a value, Is it? Have we ever questioned that value? Why should I be a somebody? Why should I be an entity? I, who just am expressed out of this vast, mysterious totality for a mere 60, 70, 100 years, with a hidden duty and a responsibility towards the totality. Why should I impose this little expression, this outcast of the universal? Why should I impose that upon the universe in terms of my little ideas? See, this is the difficulty, is it not? The supreme ego conceit. If one may put it in this form, one could say, be totally devoid of all egoism. Or if you like to put it in powerfully dramatic terms, kill out, root out all egoism, but work as those who are truly individual, fully self-aware of the meaning of egohood, who have realized egohood and are freed from all the limitations imposed upon oneself. All the limitations imposed by egoism, which means by the misconception we all have regarding what we ourselves are, each one of us. We say I, we say you. We don't know anything like the true meaning of those words. And because we do not know that true meaning, there is this continuous conflict between what we denominate the self, I, the ego, and you or the rest of the universe as the not-self. The life rhythm of the blind ego, the unawakened ego, who therefore is a person who has not realized his true egohood, that life rhythm is out of tune with the life rhythm of the totality. And hence illness. An ailment. And what is the most powerful influence that brings about that being out of tune with the life rhythm of the totality? Desire. Personal desire. Consider for a moment how personal desire arises and formulates itself. The living organism, as we all know, is a congeries of energies. It's a manifestation of energy. This energy in one's own living organism functions in ways which are determined by the blueprint of that organism. When that organism was conceived, the genes and all the rest of it more or less determine a blueprint that the life energies shall function thus and thus and thus in this particular person. And within that laid down blueprint, there is considerable elasticity allowed to and available for each individual. That blueprint works electrochemically in the living body, especially in terms of the way the actual brain itself and the nervous system and the ductless glands function. You can, up to a point, through modern scientific knowledge, alter the functioning of the ductless glands to a certain extent, but you cannot radically change it. And he is not a wise man who attempts radically to change it according to his immature likes and dislikes. It's like the little child to whom you present a gold watch. The inquisitive little fellow takes it to bits, and that's the end of the watch. Can't put it together again. And it happens all too often with individuals who want to bring about drastic changes in themselves through drugs, through all sorts of unwise experiments on themselves, through taking to various disciplines and whatnot, which will promise them nirvana, heaven, 6 weeks course, or whatever else the knaves who present all those disciplines promise, you see, and so forth. He's an unwise man. The wise man is one who will observe himself and try to understand this blueprint. This blueprint which is here is the message for us of, to use a theistic phrase, the will of God. To use a scientific, to talk in more or less scientific terms, that which the universe endows you with and allows you to bring to fulfillment. Now, the body, therefore, is the most deterministic factor in our lives. That is why the right training and care of the body is of such very great importance. And the right care will touch all the main aspects concerned with the living process of the body. Food, drink, rest, sleep, activity, exercise, and all that kind of thing. Let it be simple, let it be plain, let it be wholesome. Let it be free of the pursuit of sensational delights in any and every shape and form. The pursuit of sensational delights, the deliberate pursuit. You see where the point of desire comes in at its simplest level, the physical life level. Desire comes in there. And this exercise of preferential choice for sensation which is pleasurable as against sensation which is unpleasurable. Now, if one is wise and looks, cares for the body in the right way, the mental aspect which corresponds to this is the one in which there is no sense of proprietorship, ownership of the body. This is my body, I'll do what I like with it, you shut up. If I want to drink 5 bottles of whiskey tonight, I will. All right, but don't smash them on my head, please. See, this sense of ownership of the body, one of the fundamental errors from which the immature minds of all humanity suffer. See how the element of I'll do what I like, I want to do what I like, egoism, vanity, ignorance, pride, conceit, inward illness, all these are present. All these factors are present in that attitude. I want to do this. I like to do this. I know I have a gift along these lines and I'm going to express myself. I, who was just pressed out of the universe for 60 or 70 years, well, being 73, I'll have to say maybe 80 or 90, you see, want to assert this self in separatist terms upon the universal life rhythm. Look at the very arguments one uses. I've got only one lifetime in which to enjoy myself. But I'm going to choose my enjoyment. Can I? Supposing I was born blind, or I'm blinded in the course of my life. That is the end of all enjoyments of color. Never again. Shall never see the stars, shall never see a sunset. I'm blind. Who am I to impose my will? These things may sound trite, trivial, but they have very deep implications in terms of what happens to us ourselves in our own lives and through us to our whole environment. Because there is no such thing as a separate I. The not I, the environment, and what I call I, myself, we are inextricably interwoven into one whole. How often I've said, if there were no you, if there were no outside world, there would be no me at all. Absolutely none. Quite impossible. But we never wake up to this. Because we never wake up to it, our breath rhythm to put it at its concretest level, is not in tune with the universal life rhythm. Therefore, there is the absence of peace and the absence of pure delight. I talked about not pursuing sensational delights. Look at the other side of the coin. If I don't predetermine what delights I want and how I want them and so on, but just am sensible, sensitive, awake, observant, how shall I prevent the universal flood of delightful sensations that come pouring into me from the outer world all the time? Sights, sounds, tastes, touches, so on. Unpleasant ones also do come, true. But if you have ever really tried to be still and quiet, to be free of this itch, this ill itch, always to be doing something, not realizing that all the time you are doing something, and generally it is something which does you in. See, if one is free from this itch, and one is breathing in harmony with the universal life rhythm. Have you ever experienced that happiness, that delight? And you know, its supreme marvel, it pours into you unsought by you. And because you have not sought it, you will, in all probability, will not try to hold it and to grasp it. You will let it flow freely through you. How different from the attempt to hold and keep unto oneself. What a lesson the body has to teach us there. It needs food in order to exist at all. It takes in food, and the life rhythm of the body sets going all those processes by which digestion takes place, assimilation, and elimination. And if that is allowed to proceed naturally, one is healthy, one is well. Supposing I said, no, I've had a marvelous steak and kidney pie, I want it to remain inside me. You see the absurdity of the situation? You can see it straight away where this fact about food is concerned. We do not see this fact in relation to all our sense delights and our sense indulgences. And wanting to grasp them, to hold them, to repeat them. So, we have this insatiable craving, this thirst, which acts like a canker and becomes a cancer in our psyche. Desirelessness. be free and open to life, and the universal life will flow in and fill you with delight constantly. And let it go. Now, when that happens, you will find yourself awake in every single precious moment of time to eternity itself. You will be awake to the true humanness of you yourself, the person. And that true humanness is something which is really the living image of eternal God. When the religions of the world have taught that God made man, that man was made in the image of God, they were not wrong. It is we who are unable to see the truth of that. This sort of statement was made by those who had realized full humanity, by people who pointed out the indispensable basis for this maturity of the mind, namely the purity of the mind, a purity which involves desirelessness. Which involves the realization of true happiness, therefore, which is the crown of our physical existence.